one of the things that Maya and I found when we were writing this paper, we were looking at the discourse that precedes genocide in genocidal states, and the enhancement of a sense of victimization on the part of one of the groups, usually the group that's going to commit the genocide. First of all, their sense of being victims is much heightened by the demagogues who are trying to stir up this sort of hatred. So they basically say, look, you've been oppressed in a variety of ways, and these are the people who did it, and they're not going to stop doing it, and this time we're going to get them before they get us. It's something like that. And so there's something very pathological about the enhancement of victimization, which is, well, see, that the problem, as far as I'm concerned with it, is it's not thought through very well. Because there's a point that's being made, and the point is that people have been oppressed and they suffer. And that's true, that point. But then the proper framework from within which to interpret that, I believe, is that that's characteristic of life. You can't take it personally in some sense. And you can't divide the world neatly into perpetrators and victims. And you certainly can't divide the world neatly into perpetrators and victims and then assume that you're only in the victim class and then assume that that gives you certain, like, access to certain forms of redress, let's say. It gets dangerous very rapidly if you do that sort of thing. So, for example, one of the things that characterized the Soviet Union, and this was particularly true in the 1920s, but afterwards, so the Soviets were very much enamored of the idea of class guilt. So, for example, although it was only about 40 years previously that the serfs had been emancipated, they weren't much more than slaves, right? And so that was the bulk of the Russian population. They were bought and sold along with the land. So they had been emancipated, and some of them, many of them, had turned into independent farmers, and some of them had become reasonably prosperous because, at least in principle, I presume a certain proportion of them from being crooked, but I presume a larger proportion from actually being able to raise food. And of course, at that time, the bulk of the Russian food population was produced by these relatively successful peasant farmers. And relatively successful would mean maybe they had a brick house or something, and maybe they had a couple of cows, and maybe they were able to hire a few people. And so, you know, it wasn't like they were massive landowners or anything. But I've talked to you a little bit about the Pareto principle and the notion that in any domain of activity, a small proportion of people end up producing most of what's in that domain of activity. The same was true in Russia with regards to these peasant farmers. Some of them were extraordinarily efficient, and they produced most of Russia's food. When the communists came in, they described those landholders as parasites, essentially, predicated on the Marxist idea that if someone had extracted profit from an enterprise, that they had basically stolen that profit from the people, say, that they had employed or otherwise oppressed. And so you could be a member of the kulak, K-U-L-A-C-A-K, K-U-L-A-K. You could be a member of the kulak class. And then because you were a member of that class, you were automatically guilty. And so what happened was, and you got to think this through to really understand what happened. So what happened was the intellectual communists were sent out in cadres out into these little towns to find people who would help them round up the kulaks. Now you got to think about what a small town is like, because, so imagine you're in a town and there's three or four people or maybe 10 people or something like that who are a little more successful than everyone else. And a certain number of people are going to be fine with that and maybe even happy about it because they regard those people as particularly productive and, you know, as stalwart members of the community, regardless of their flaws. But there's going to be some people who are not happy about it at all, that are going to be very resentful about that and jealous. And so those are going to be people whose characters, I would say, are of the less positive type. And so when the intellectuals came in and described the reason that these people should be treated as parasites and profiteers, then it was the resentful minority in those towns, and that would be the kind of guy that hangs around in the bar all the time and is completely unconscientious and fails at everything and then blames everyone else for it. The intellectuals came in and said, this is unfair that this happened to you. You've actually been victimized, and now it's your opportunity to go have your revenge. And so that's exactly what happened. Now, in some of the villages, sometimes the peasants would actually surround the, the farmsteads of these more successful people and try to defend them, but that never worked out for very long. And so then these mobs, these angry mobs, would go into the farmhouses and strip the place right down to nothing. And they packed these people up and sent them on trains with no food out to Siberia, where there was no place to live. And so that they were packed into houses, you know, maybe they had a square meter each to live in, and all their children died of typhoid, and many of them froze to death. Many, many people died. Millions of people died as a consequence of the de-Kulakization, at least in as a consequence of its total effect. So what happened then was that there wasn't any food produced. And so then 6 million Ukrainians starved to death in the 1920s, which is something you never hear about, right? You never hear about that. Why do you never hear about that? That's a question worth asking. You know, it was an absolute catastrophe. They used to, so these people were starving, right to the point of cannibalism, right? I mean, it was ugly as anything you could possibly imagine. If you were a mother, and so you're supposed to hand all your grain into the Central Committee, mostly for distribution into the cities. You didn't get to keep any for yourself. And so maybe then afterwards, if you were a mother, you'd go out in the fields that had already been harvested, and you'd pick up individual grains of wheat. And if you didn't turn those in, that was death for you. So that's how far it was pushed. So that's a little story about how the idea of victimization and perpetration can get out of hand extraordinarily rapidly. And so whenever people are beating the victim drum, you know, they'll cover that up with empathy, roughly speaking. We're speaking on behalf of the oppressed. It's like, maybe you are, but maybe you're no saint because, you know, you're so sure that you're a saint and you're only speaking from the position of good. It's highly unlikely.
This is the answer to defeat the leftist stranglehold that's on our society.
Okay, so we'll untangle some of that. Okay, so first of all, the first observation is a really interesting one, because you know that things can go out of hand very, very rapidly.
Yeah.
And the reason they do that is because of positive feedback loops. Now, the thing that Kurzweil talks about is a positive feedback loop. An intelligent machine makes another intelligent machine that makes another intelligent machine. And that's a positive feedback loop, and that can spiral upwards out of control very rapidly. And that's what polarization is. It's like, I tap you, you tap me. I slap you, you punch me. Well, up it goes. Well, I think that's partly why in the New Testament, for example, there's an injunction that says, turn the other cheek, resist not evil. Why? Because otherwise you get into a positive feedback loop, and then you better look the hell out. And things can tilt very, very rapidly. I mean, all you have to do, look at what happened in World War I. No one expected that. It was like one relatively minor member, I think, of the aristocracy, if I remember correctly, was assassinated in one minor little country. It's like, bang, everything fell apart. And that's positive feedback loops, right? And so that's what we're in right now. And we've got to be, and that's a really chaotic time. And so I would say, maintain self-control and don't aim to win. Aim at peace. Because winning, that's not peace. It's better to aim for peace. You know, and I've got this talk coming up on November 11th. I'm quite worried about it because I know there's going to be protesters there and that they've been emboldened by the fact that they shut the talk down before. And I want to make a video, I'll probably do it tomorrow, telling everyone that comes to that meeting to, like, watch their bloody step and stay out of the gutter. Because we're at a point now where, under the wrong circumstances, if the wrong person does the wrong thing, that the consequences will be very grave. Now, we can't predict which action is going to precipitate that, or even if that will happen. But it's chaotic enough so that it could happen. So, you know, so govern yourselves accordingly. Now, the problem is that there are people who would be happy if there was blood running in the street. They're the same sort of people that shoot up high schools or kill innocent, you know, elementary school kids just to show what they're made of and what they believe. And that's a big problem. But
for the rest of us, like hopefully calmer heads can prevail. And so it really is important not to win. It's like fighting with your wife. You don't win. You can't, because you have to live with her. But you can't win. But maybe you can solve the problem and bring about peace. And so you got to practice doing that. Practice restraint. Now, and remember, too, that the people that you're talking about who are radical leftists, is most of the time they're not. Like, they're 95% like you. And if you pull them out of the mob, they're just like your neighbor's 19-year-old kid who's kind of clueless and rebellious, right? And who you might even like. You put them in the mob, it's a whole different thing. And so you got to remember that, too.
Out of fear of social isolation, it's kind of how they're acting out, you're saying.
No, it's just that they're possessed by these ideas, but only partially. You know, you hardly find a full-blooded, absolutely committed, radical leftist activist, you know, like, there are some, but not very many. Most of it is just fragmentary behavior, and you have to remember that. Like, when the students come out to protest me, was the case particularly at McMaster, I have to remember, these kids, they're not much different than my kids. They are when they're in a stupid mob behind a hammer and sickle flag, you know, but you don't want to make a low-resolution, homogeneous representation of them. And so you, that's why, again, I think, instead of winning, you turn to your own development. You turn to your own development. You do what you can to stop doing the things that you're doing that aren't good. Because you're not going to hurt anybody if you do that. All you're going to do is help. And otherwise, you'll participate in this polarization. And that's, unless you want that, and, you know, there's a dark part of people that, it's part of the part that voted for Trump would like to burn things to the ground. It's like, to hell, I know how people felt when they went into the voting booth. It was like, Hillary, Hillary, to hell with it, Trump. You know, and that's a hell of a thing to say, to hell with it, you know. Although I could certainly understand that sentiment. So we have to be careful. And all of you people who are here, who are advocates of free speech and who are theoretically happy to come hear me speak, it's like, I really do believe it. I truly believe this. And this is something I learned in part from Solzhenitsyn and in part from Jung, is that the way that you set the world straight is by constraining the malevolence in your own heart. And that's no joke, man. That's no easy thing. And that's a good voyage for people to go on if they want something difficult and worthwhile to do. So,
thank you very much.
All right, so how did you find PragerU?
I stumbled across it on YouTube a few months ago because, you know, with the whole George Floyd protest happening and COVID and this election coming up, things were just getting so political, and so many of my peers were posting these really radical messages on Instagram about, you know, how disgusting the right is and, you know, down with capitalism, down with white people, down with America. And I just thought, if this is the left, this really isn't me. So I thought, you know, I haven't been exposed to conservative thought. I've grown up in Southern California. I've gone to really liberal schools. Let me just Google, you know, what do conservatives think about X? And the first thing that came up was PragerU. And I watched one video and I didn't sleep that night because I kept clicking on the next one, the next one, the next one, the 5-minute videos. And it was just like a political awakening. It sounds, you know, dumb of me to say now because I know so much now, but I just never really knew that people thought this way. Because when you grow up in such a bubble, and those are the messages you're getting from the members of your community, your school, you know, your extracurricular activities, it can be overwhelming. So it just totally changed the way I view everything.
You're our dream. You're our purpose.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, obviously. You know, it's interesting. The very fact that you even Googled what do conservatives have to say about X, Y, or Z is a credit to you.
Thank you.
It's a credit to us that we're such an effective spokesman, but you get 50% of the credit. I mean, I'm not. And I'm not patronizing you. It's just a fact. You sought something different. I find that very touching. I got the chills when you said you binge watched that night.
I did. I seriously been in the fireside chats and the Candace Owens podcast. And then the great thing about PragerU is you have these speakers like Larry Elder, Thomas Sowell come on. And it was kind of like a jumping off point. And I'm like, oh my God, look at all these fabulous conservative scholars that I did not know about. And it just completely opened up my world.
It's a scandal that those people are not, that Tom Sowell is not a household name in academia.
It's awful.
It's a moral and intellectual scandal.
It is.
There isn't a black leftist scholar on earth who comes close to Tom Sowell intellect.
I agree. And the thing is, you don't have to, what I try to tell my friends, I told some of them I was coming in today to talk to you, and they said, oh, Julie, you got to be aware of PragerU, that's propaganda. And it's so ridiculous because so many leftists love to vilify the right. And what I want to say to them is you don't have to agree with everything Dennis Prager says, or Thomas Sowell, or Larry Elder, or any of these people. You just have to listen to it. And what's so awful to me about my generation is they won't even listen to the other side. If you aren't on the very far left, you're racist, you're sexist, you're canceled. I mean, a great example is I was talking to some of my friends about abortion, and I happen to be pro-choice, even though some of my other views have shifted right, but I still am pro-choice. But I was advocating for pro-life people, and they went, Julie, don't you know all pro-life people are sexist? And it's like, you know, when you got to listen.
They can't be sexist because men give birth. By their own criteria, we can't be sexist.
But they won't. I said to them, if you listen to people who are advocating for, you know, a pro-life stance, they're not saying, I want a woman to carry a baby that she doesn't want to carry because I want to oppress her. It's they're not saying that. They're saying that they value human life. That's why it's called pro-life, not pro-oppress women.
You're an American of any race, you're lucky to be an American. Get that? People will know it one day. I hope it's not too late. In Oregon, they have an old saying in the lumber industry, you don't know the height of a tree until it falls. That's my fear. People will remember how great America was after the left destroys it. Article in Teen Vogue I mentioned last hour. That private property is wrong. There should not be any private property. You know how stupid the author is? Do you realize that? Do you realize the ignorance of communism? There was no private property in the Soviet Union. People thrived. What was it? Three families to an apartment? You know how that is for human relations? No, private property is the basis of liberty. But they don't give a damn about liberty. I mean, why does she? I don't even understand how it works. What does it mean, no private property? She says, that way you don't have to pay any rent. Well, I don't understand that. Who makes the apartment building? Who keeps it up? It's shouldn't even bother. Teen Vogue. I don't know. Are teens reading Teen Vogue? I don't know. It's a Marxist paper. That's how ironic. That is correct. Now you realize how true what I've said every week for 20 years. The happy make the world better, the unhappy make it worse. That's correct. That's the way it works. I'm Dennis Prager. This is the Happiness Hour. Happiness is a moral issue, not just an emotional issue. We are obligated to act happy even if we don't feel it, because we cannot impose bad moods on others. And on the macro, happy people do not ruin the world. Happy people do not riot. Is that fair to say? By definition, happy people do not riot. I didn't say do not protest. I said do not riot. And there are many, many reasons for the widespread unhappiness in our society. The biggest is no meaning in life. With the death of religion and the death of belief in America as the last best hope of Earth, as Lincoln put it, what's left? No pun intended, because what's left is left. Those are the biggest. There are a lot of other reasons for widespread unhappiness. A lot of spoiled children. Parents who raised children with the belief that the most important thing was that they always be happy. And I'm the happiest guy. It's ironic, isn't it? Your task is not to make your child happy. Your task is to make your child good. Then they'll be happy. That's the way it works. You want your child happy at all times, you will, by definition, neglect their character. In fact, I mean, as it happens, you would even neglect their health. Oh, make you happy to have more ice cream? Have more ice cream. It's funny, though, they wouldn't do that on health. They do it on character. But they don't do it on health. The other thing is parents want it to be loved. Parents should want to be parents, loved or not. Your task is to be a parent. So there are a lot of reasons for the widespread unhappiness in America. We talk about them every week. So I have not done an open line Happiness Hour since when? Since May. 3 months. I did an open line in May? Interesting. So yeah, that makes sense. 4 times a year. If you have to have stuff on your mind you'd like to talk about, I'm sure your challenges to your happiness right now. I can't fix it, but we could talk about it. Yeah. May 8th. It's 3 months. Is it 3 months exactly? Yeah, basically. 1-8-PRAGER, 776-877-243-7776. How do you look at life differently today than you did, or America, or your children, or your spouse, or your own life? Those are good subjects, too. But I want to deal with your happiness issues at this time. I'll tell you mine, okay? You know how open I am with you. I am less happy. I don't act it because I follow my own advice, but I am less happy because of my worries about this country. There is no guarantee that a free society will remain free. There is none. That's the story. That's the historical record, isn't it? There is no guarantee that the values that made the society possible will endure. There are vast numbers of people who loathe them. Objectivity, punctuality, personal responsibility, individuality, Judeo-Christian values, these were all posted as white values at an African-American museum in Washington. Well, if they're being listed as white values as opposed to universally good values, That bothers me, and it does affect my happiness. I'm not I never fake you. I'm not going to patronize you. I have too much respect for you. Of course, it's affected me. We could lose this great country. The world could lose it. It could become another country, corrupt like so many others. So I fight, and I spoke to you a lot about how fighting does give one some degree of happiness, because it is our task to do good in this world. Whether we accomplish the task or not, it's in God's hands. You know, I'm writing a Bible commentary. At the very end of the fifth book of the Torah, the first five books, the most important books, because they made Judaism and they made Christianity. And they made the rest of the Bible, let's put it that way. That's an easier way, perhaps, to understand the importance of the first five books. And they end with Moses not getting into the promised land. It's always struck me as a parable for all our lives. Very, very few people see the promised land or get into the promised land, whatever their promised land is. Just the way it is in life, but it doesn't free you from the struggle. You know, I wonder, as I'm thinking aloud here, I wonder if young Americans do not identify with America, think that all of those who died fighting for America died in vain. If the country is systemically awful, why die for it, right? I wonder what they would answer. I suspect that most of these people don't celebrate Memorial Day anyway. So what's on your mind? That's the question here as we continue, and I'll go to your calls.
I think the capacity for evil is something that is not easily distinguishable from strength. You know, and I mean, my knowledge runs out at this level of analysis in some sense. The world seems to be structured so that we can act for the good and we can act for evil. And I think that's associated with self-consciousness. And I think that's illustrated in the story of Adam and Eve. When Adam and Eve become self-conscious, the scales fall from their eyes. They realize that they're naked. And to realize that you're naked is to understand your vulnerability. That's why Adam and Eve clothed themselves right away. Oh no, I'm naked. I can be hurt. Okay, I can be hurt. I have to clothe myself. I have to protect myself in the future. You actually become aware of that in a way that animals aren't. Well, what does it mean that you're naked? It means that everyone else is too. Yeah. What does it mean that you can be hurt? It means that everyone else can be hurt too. It means that you could hurt them. And that's why the knowledge of good and evil goes along with the knowledge of nakedness. That took me a long time to figure out. It took me about 30 years to figure that out. So why are those two things conjoined? Oh, yes. When you understand that you're vulnerable, you understand that everyone else is vulnerable, and then you have the option of exploiting that. And so that's what transforms human beings to some degree from animals, because a predator just eats you. But a human being can play with you and will for all sorts of reasons. Now, the capacity to do that, though, why is the capacity to do that, let's say, useful? Well, it's useful to be strong and not to have to use it, because it makes you formidable. And I think that you have to be formidable in order to move forward properly in the world, even to get through obstacles that aren't, just to get through obstacles. You have to have some strength of character. You have to have some commitment. And some of that is there will be a cost if you interfere with me. It'll be the minimal cost necessary. Let's say if you've got yourself under control, it will be the minimal cost necessary, but do not be thinking there won't be a cost. And I don't believe that if that's not built into your character, then you have no strength, and you certainly have no strength when you're pushed by someone who's malevolent. A bully, if you're like that, if the bully pushes you and your response is, there will be a cost for pushing me, and you will pay it, then the bully will go elsewhere. And we know that too from studies of bullies, you know, like even childhood bullies, they push around kids, and then they find the ones that retreat and withdraw, and they bully them. So, and you know, you might think, well, usually children are bullied because of some abnormality. That's a very common idea. It's like, there's a guy named Dan Olweus, a very smart Norwegian psychologist, and he studied bullying for a long time as a precursor to fascism, by the way, so that was his interest. He said his analysis indicated that at least 3/4 of children have some obvious abnormality that could be the focus of bullying attention. It might even be your name. It doesn't take much of a genius bully to come up with a good way of making fun of your name, or you're too tall, or you're too short, or, you know, or your brother's too tall or too short, or there's something. It isn't the abnormality that is the cause of the bullying. It's the abnormality might become the focus of the bullying, but part of the cause is the withdrawal in the face of the bullies, because the bully thinks he can get away with it. Well, if you're, and it's also the case with children who are preyed upon by adult predators. Like, adult predators of children look for children who are easily cowed and who won't put up a fight. So, for example, if you're teaching your children to be terrified of strangers, that's really not a very good strategy. You want kids who are confident and who will make a noise if someone messes about with them, and who are, and so that characterological strength has to be built in. This is how I think reality lays itself out. I think we all know this. You're not driven by your past like a clock. You're not deterministic. You are to some degree, because you're limited. You're a limited creature. You've got rules that you run by and all of that. You know, you're not omniscient. But you're not driven by the past. What you do instead is confront the potential of the future. That's what's in front of you. So it's a domain with multiple pathways, and that's what's always in front of you. You could go there, you could go there, you could go there. There's an array of choices that confront you. You confront that as soon as you wake up and become conscious in the morning. And then there's all this potential that's there in front of you, and you use your ethical choice to determine which of those possibilities will become actual. And it's through that mechanism that you participate in the creation of reality. And that's the making of you in the image of God, because that's what God did at the beginning of time, according to our old stories, right? Spoke and transformed potential into the being that was good. And that was dependent on using truthful speech. So that's what you do if you act properly, is you confront potential and you translate it into reality. And it's your soul that does that. Well, do you follow the story? That's a fundamental religious question. You know, when people go to see a movie like Pinocchio, which is a movie I've taken apart online in some detail, it's like they suspend disbelief. No one thinks that a wooden puppet has become alive. No one questions why the wooden puppet should rescue his father from the chaos of the whale. It all just makes sense. It's like, well, yeah, but why does it make sense exactly? And isn't it interesting to notice that it makes sense? And these stories have a pattern, and the pattern has a function, and that's a religious function. You say, well, I don't know whether I believe. It's like, well, you follow the story. The Harry Potter books are a good example of that, because they have a deeply, deeply religious substructure. And that's why they were so insanely popular. You know, they have to speak for a book to become that popular. Yeah. It has to speak to something that's in everyone. Because otherwise, why would they become that popular? You know, and in the second volume, Harry confronts the basilisk, the thing that turns you to stone, that lurks underneath the magic castle. It's like, well, that's life. That's Jaws. It's the same story. It's like we have a structure, It's kind of magical. We live inside it. It's a hierarchy. But underneath, there's chaos and terror. And that can come up at any time and paralyze you with its gaze, right? Turn you to stone because it's so awful. And every building is like that. And so what do you have to do is you have to go down into the depths and confront that thing voluntarily. And then you find, and you'll find what's of great value in that pursuit and be reborn. It's like, well, that's the Harry Potter story. That's the second volume. It's like, well, everyone knows that story. Do you believe it? Well, do you act it out? That's the question. Do you act it out? It's the right pattern, I think. And maybe, you know, maybe it's not even the right pattern. Maybe the human race is a hopeless race and there's no destination for us. But for better or worse, that's our pattern. Our pattern is the snakes are after us. Well, we can cower in our dens, or we can go out and we can find the source of the snakes and we can contend with it. And that's what we decided to do. And God only knows how long ago, millions of years, we decided we weren't going to cower in our dens. We were going to go out and root out the snakes. It's like St. Patrick or St. George. And then we found, well, there was the snakes that will eat you. And then there were the snakes that were in other people's hearts. And then there were the snakes that were in your hearts. And all those had to be contended with and rooted out. And that's part of the even deeper mythology. Is that, like, there's an association in Christianity between the snake in the Garden of Evil, of Eden, and Satan. It's like, well, where did that come from? What kind of crazy idea is that? Well, I just laid out the idea. It's like, there's always a snake. What's the worst possible snake? Well, it isn't an actual snake. It's a metaphorical snake. It's the snake that's in the heart of your enemy when he comes to burn down your city. Well, what if you get rid of your enemies? Well, the snake's still there. Well, then it's in your heart. So what's the ultimate battle? The ultimate battle is with the snake in your heart. I had this kid talk to me at a barbecue I was at this weekend, and he's working with delinquent kids, 13 and 14 years old. And he said they were pulled out of other delinquent camps and brought to his camp, which was for the worst delinquents. And he started talking to them about my lectures. And so they've been watching him, and now they have a little fan club that's based around my lectures, and they're doing things like talking to each other about making their beds and cleaning up their rooms. It's like, it's unbelievable how little genuine encouragement many people need and how they had none. No one ever said to them and meant it, it's not okay for you to be a weak loser. It's not okay. And the reason it's not okay is because you could be way more than that. And it's a crime, an ethical crime, for you to allow all that necessary potential to go to waste. It hurts you, it hurts your family, it hurts the world. Really, really, it does.